This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, May 28th, 2010. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, prodigious poetry. In music, you have violinist Joshua Bell and cellist Yo-Yo Ma, who were both famous before they turned 10. We won't even talk about Mozart, who was writing operas practically before he was out of diapers. In art, there's young Picasso and a super precocious Leonardo da Vinci, who awed their elders with their early talent. In poetry, one thinks of John Keats, who came into his own in his teens. Or did he?
If you look at the things that Keats wrote when he was 18, they're not great.
That's Christian Wyman, the editor of Poetry Magazine. I asked him if he could think of any contemporary poet prodigies.
Dylan Thomas wrote some poems when he was 18 that are pretty terrific, and then he reworked them. Some of his most famous poems actually were notes that he started when he was 18. So it certainly happened. You know, I think it's probably just as no more common or more rare now than it was in other times.
A couple of years ago, Poetry Magazine got a submission from a poet who was still in high school. It made its way to Wyman's desk.
You know, I tend to read things first without looking at the letters or anything like that, so I just read the poems and get a feel for them first. And then I went back and discovered how young he was and couldn't really believe it. I thought it was probably a hoax, actually.
It wasn't.
I submitted work, and I guess Chris Wyman over there liked it.
That's the young poet himself, Alan Edwin Butt. Wyman published two of his poems in 2009.
You know, usually when you get a young poet, a really young poet, what you'll notice, if they're good, is an extreme development of language, extreme sensitivity to language, but not much else behind it. And Dylan Thomas is a good example of that. If you look at those poems, those early poems, I mean, they're fantastic sonically. But you stare at them for a little while and you begin to think, what's he saying there? That's not all that profound. What's interesting about Alan Butt's work is that it doesn't make huge claims linguistically. He's not intoxicated with his own virtuosity, which is often what happens with young poets.
Alan Butt just finished up his sophomore year at Presbyterian College in South Carolina. In the current June 2010 issue of Poetry, Wyman published him again, this time a long, ambitious poem.
And the poem is toned down quite a bit. It's almost, flat is the wrong word for it. It's measured, sculpted. And that kind of maturity is very rare.
The primary voices in the poem are, I'm uncomfortable saying my own, although it is my own. You know,
there's a lyric voice.
More or less analogous to myself. Yeah. And a woman named Julia Fogelsong is the other character that speaks in the poem, who is sort of exploring the implications of her marriage and what it means to say that she loves her husband, especially in light of some pretty severe marital problems.
Yeah. Now, the poem is sexually quite graphic, so the people who might be offended by that should tune in next week and skip the rest of this program. A lot of poets would shy away from the sort of sexual explicitness that you have in this poem. Were you uncomfortable with it, writing it?
Not really. I was a little more uncomfortable showing my parents the poem that was going to appear in a major magazine this summer.
Yeah.
That was actually the first part of the poem that I conceived of. You know, the line that kept coming to me was, at the onset of my husband's impotence. And I was like, well, I need to do something with this.
Well, the poem is modernist, first of all, in that it's a collage of seemingly disparate elements with no transition. At the end, the voices begin to merge into a single awareness.
So let's hear Alan Butt read some extended excerpts from his poem, which is broken up into discrete sections. I'm going to rudely insert myself into these pauses between the sections just to reorient us. The poem is called If Briefly. Here's Alan Butt.
Sometimes in times near unassailable sang-froid, there is a thawing, and the memory asserts its musicality again, reminds one that it is at heart, heart's artificer.
So that's the main lyric voice announcing the theme, a meditation on time and memory. In the next section, the speaker recalls the black sand beaches of Okinawa, where he spent time as a child. He is interrupted several times by Julia Fogelsong with brief, broken-up statements. In the text, her words are set off by quotes, so you can tell them apart, but you won't be able to hear that, so it might be a bit disorienting.
Somewhere in Okinawa, there are stairs. My husband is the only constant in. Our concrete stairs that lead one, or at least led me, age 6, near straight from top to bottom of a cliff face, and they ended in a black sand beach, the only constant in my life. When I was young, I would have thought I would regret it, to have wrapped myself up like a caterpillar in a man. But if my name, like his, is Fogelsong, then I must half recede with him, and only half of me is Julia. And that fades too. So call me, if you call me, Mrs. Fogelsong. At that age, having lived before in Florida, it seemed like a miraculous affront that a beach could shuffle off the purity of sand, and satisfying to have seen it after the descent of stairs. At least 300, each laborious at 6, my body hardly large enough to bear its density in time. Knowing little, still I felt exhilaration that a new piece of the world would stand, if briefly, out of time, and therefore out of me, if I am what I occupy of it. The body hates to be discounted in this way, says it encloses any love the heart pretends to, like the stairs, a downward tedium, but still the necessary setting of the beach, as gems are set in rings that, though of precious metals, lack the brilliance of the gems and go unnoticed, though they lift the whole from what it risks.
The next section is entirely in the voice of Julia Fogelsong.
At the onset of my husband's impotence, I thought myself in part, if not entirely, responsible, and I ascribed the blame to our, admittedly, unsensational sex habits, to our bed not cold, perhaps, but let's be frank, a little bored with us. Therefore, 38 and only just confronted with my inexperience that bordered on extended childhood, I contemplated, then resolved to take his penis in my mouth. It was not lightly I decided this. I am, perhaps, anachronistic, though no prude. My husband and I, if you will excuse vulgarity, fucked constantly when young and not infrequently until this roadblock. But it struck me somehow as unseemly hitherto. My husband, when I told him what I meant to do, looked pleased, as though decorum only kept him 20 years long from requesting it. He tried to guide me as I started, both his hands like tethers not unkind to what they hold. And he was kind to me, spoke kindly as I ran my tongue across him, tasting faintly of his sweat, but not unpleasant. On the whole, not bad to do this, though my faith flagged somewhat as his prick lay flaccid in my mouth, its stubbornness infuriating. I could feel his disappointment, selfish maybe, but no more so than is fair in love, for he, of course, was not a stranger to this act. No sense in skipping what embarrasses. I knew at least once in the time since our marriage he had been with someone else, though it had been a while by now. She had told me, long my friend and full of guilt. I told her bitterness was foreign to me, which is almost true, that she shouldn't worry, though I'd rather that she not encourage him to seek a second tryst. Not much by then that I could do to change what they had done, and I believed at that time, as I said, I was responsible. Could mend it so he'd never feel the need to cheat again. Can't know now whether I was right, though sometimes I consider asking him. As I considered then, but as I built my courage up, he stiffened. Just as well, I thought, I couldn't stand him looking at me with that awful mix of pity and of boredom. And I threw my heart into the act, as one who plows the earth with spite for it, his anger lightening his labor, that the ground break open for his putting in the seed. I will not lie fallow always, though my body rot. The thick warmth running in my mouth like bitter salt dissolved in water, like the ocean beautiful, though full of bloated fish.
Now we go back to the main lyric voice with more thoughts on the nature of time and memory.
Looking at the ocean, it does not at first cohere. The waves seem merely limits that the eyes have introduced, imposed to force a pattern on enormity, which one does not encounter often made particular, and we are in it, where we cautiously avoid the undertow. Time made us, time will make us till we tire of it absolutely what we are, and still so thin the slightest puncture tears this curtain of a body off me. Then I am as one who, secretly apart, participant of it, pretends to volunteer to vanish at a state fair magic show that seeks its charm in its predictability.
Now we'll skip a section and go back to the woman, then back to the main lyric voice and Okinawa.
And if my love is only my invention, that is unimportant, since to say I love him therefore makes it so. To be content is to be so by choice. My friend, when she had told me that he came inside her, crying, choked with guilt and pleasure, which we all know will intoxicate when mixed, was simply unaware that happiness is mine by right if I declare it, like the moon with our absurd flag. In Okinawa also, I cannot remember where this lies in time, before the black sand beach or after, I awoke at 2 o'clock one morning, sick, unable to return to sleep, never having woken up so early, having never understood that 2 o'clock is full dark stretched like gauze across one corner of the earth. My father took me somewhere with him. Maybe there was someone he had told he'd meet, and likely told me, but my memory has found no use for it. We stood outside the car, under streetlights, in a parking lot near home. And while he spoke with some man, wholly wiped from time I've known, I watched a dozen dragonflies fly circles underneath the streetlight. And I knew the time of day in which I stood was new, and tried to watch the dragonflies with desperate attention, knowing 2 o'clock was something that existed now with being stony smirk. One doesn't see these things again.
That was Alan Edwin Butt reading excerpts from his poem, If Briefly, which is in the June 2010 issue of Poetry. You can hear and read the whole poem, uninterrupted, on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Do let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.